the month of Adar, on the 13th of the day, on the 13th of the month, etc. Okay, and Ahasuerus says, Lishloach mevachshei ra'atam, he's going to help them overcome the evildoers, the people that would do evil unto them. Ve'ish lo amad lifneim ki nafal pachadam al kol ha'amim v'chol sarei medinot, all the officials, what was going to be that they were going to actually be able to fulfill all of what now Ahasuerus is saying the Jews may fulfill. And the sons of Haman hang on the tree. And then finally, towards the end of the perek, it says the following. The Jews got up and they accepted upon themselves al zaram and upon their generations to come. Va'al kol ha'nilvim aleihem v'lo ya'avor lihiyod osim et shnei ha'yamim ha'ele kichtavam l'chizmanam, that we're not going to pass over these 2 days, right? We said that there are 2 days, 14th and the 15th, depending on which kind of city you're in. You read the Megillah on the different days. V'chol shana v'shana, every year. That's verse 27. So what have we established by verse 27 in the Megillah? That it is during this time, it's this kind of celebration. It's going to be upon not only ourselves, but it's going to be upon generations to come, and it's going to be every year. So, do I need any more about what's going to happen in the future? I really don't need anything more about what's going to happen in the future. I've now outlined it's going to be Shana l'Shana. V'hayamim ha'ele nizkarim v'nasim b'chol dor v'ador. Oh, there's a parallelism perhaps, or there's a repetition of the fact that it's going to be for every generation. Mishpacha mishpacha, family family, medina medina, ir v'ir. Remember we went through the beginning of the tractate to say, what does that really mean? V'yamei ha'purim ha'ele, these days of Purim, lo yavru mitoch ha'yudim. These days of Purim shall not be forgotten. They shall not pass over them. So what does that mean? Is that a restatement that every year it's going to actually happen for the Jews? It's got to be something different. What's the something different? That it's going to be in the time to come. And that it's prophetic. And it's not about the kind of time that we're thinking generation to generation, year to year, all the way through every generation, 20 generations, 30 generations, really children bearing children bearing children. It's going to be about the time of what? Olam Haba. It's going to be about the world to come. And in the world to come, and in the Messianic age, Purim is going to remain a festival.
Can we drink of Olam Haba?
And, yeah, why not? And in the sense that it's going to be for Olam Haba, and that it's actually written here as a prophecy, the Gemara brings it back and Rav Yosef says, that's the proof. That's the proof that it's divine. Because that verse told you about the world to come. And how could anybody know about the world to come except for who? Except for God. So they really bring it down to the level of seeing within the text a level of nevuah in this case that makes it about God's being involved in the production of the book. Rav Nachman.
Generally accepted that that's what that means?
Well, that's our tradition. That in Olam Haba we're still going to have Purim.
Is there any other day that we will not celebrate Olam?
Let's say in the next world.
Is there any holiday of our holidays that we would not celebrate in Olam Haba?
Some people say it's only Purim.
So we will be
every day is going to be like Shabbat. It's going to be no work. There's going to be banquets. People feed you. Your neighbor helps you. And Purim's still going to be around.
So there's no other reference to any other Yontif that will occur in the year, in the world to come, except
one tradition significantly holds that Purim which is a world upside down, a different world, will still be celebrated. Sending portions to friends and providing for those who don't maybe have enough, even though in the world to come it doesn't sound like anybody's going to be lacking. But Purim will be, in other words, Purim will be read, the great victory. We'll remember what the world was like, perhaps. It's a big question, if you want to really get into the question of, let's say, for instance, that we really are accepting that that is one tradition and we want to explore. Why that tradition? What is it about Purim that would make us included or make some drush on the world to come think about including it as the one holiday, the one day of remembering? Right? Because we have so many other days of remembering.
Passover would be a much better candidate for that in terms of redemption.
So Passover, why not Passover?
Exactly.
But let's focus in and say, why Purim? What is it about Purim that could lead somebody to surmise that that would be the holiday in Olam Haba?
Beats me. Why Purim? Of all the holidays, the holiday that you celebrate the least.
So all the other days are going to be like Shabbat?
Basically.
So
can we have Purim on Shabbat?
They're like Shabbat.
I like Shabbat. It's not Shabbat. Otherwise, we can't
say Purim. There's no sighing. Because we don't sigh on Shabbat.
And even when we do, that's a prayer.
I'll take a spot.
Okay.
Good.
I think it's because it's so much wrapped up with Jewish identity in the diaspora. And not losing Jewish identity in the diaspora. And the reckoning with being Jewish in a non-Jewish world.
But in the world to come.
You should never forget that.
But is there any remembrance in the world to come?
What's that?
Are we going to reckon with other people who aren't?
Are there going to be religions in the world to come?
Everybody's going to be Jewish.
At least God's going to teach Torah from Jerusalem in the general conception.
Right.
However,
not everybody can be Jewish.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be really easy to forget. we had these ideas.
We've got to guard against forgetting.
Look, it's not easy to put our finger on these things. And
what period does this Midrash or Agadah?
Right. So let's take the historical reality.
Let's get some
Midrash. That kind of conception of the world to come starts with apocalyptic texts in 3rd century BCE.
No, I meant about Purim.
And then right. So and I'm saying so about Purim. If you take that this text has any roots from any time, it's in a 3rd century BCE framework, and yeah, and then definitely if you're talking about the oral traditions that we have about the Megillah canonization happens in 1st century BCE to 1st century CE, and those are really established. And for sure, these Midrashic traditions are not productions of later Stamaim. I don't think that that's the case. Hi, how are you?
Thank you.
Okay. So, we go around and we say that there's a certain sense of redeeming, there's a certain sense of redeeming ourselves, and it's not only God, but it's ourselves in this picture. It's the geopolitics, it's the political intrigue, it's the human beings, and you know, who knows if you got to this place because of the need right now that we have as I think that there's a certain level of, even in the world to come, there's a drama of human existence that we don't want to deny. That's the best that I can see with this kind of dramatic presentation of human political intrigue and the kind of community that we ultimately build and the kind of mitzvot that the rabbis see, you know, with the reading of text, it's still a textual reality. With the sending portions to friends, it's still that you have Ben Adam Chaveiro between a person and his fellow. You have the uplifting of the poor, because who knows really if everybody will feel their part in Olam Haba. The rabbis were very practical about Olam Haba in a certain way, even though they saw the potential of God's rule and people reconciling and Torah coming out of Jerusalem. You know, they could still see the potential Messiah as someone taking off and putting on bandages, sitting at the gate as a leper. You could still sense that the rabbis in Olam Haba wanted neighbors to be good to one another, because if you couldn't bend your arms at the great banquet, you needed somebody else to help you eat. I think there's a certain element of that in Purim. So?
So, the concept that you're quoting about Olam Haba, I don't hear very much reference to it, only occasionally. Is this fall into a certain period that most of these, you know, concepts are, or is it continual throughout? Is it particularly described in times of war, persecution and suffering here, so that there is a yearning and a kind of fantasizing about it? Where do those...
Yeah, for sure, the notion of, if you talk about social history and productivity of ideas, in that sense, that Olam Haba represents, in a symbolic way, a reward for suffering through the plague of history. So the period of great, great suffering under the exile were the beginnings in the prophetic literature. And then during the rabbinic period, and the conception of resurrection, and we see a sense of Olam Haba coming out through Midrash and in the Gemara because of some of the persecution, the colonization. So there's one perek in Sanhedrin that, you know, even though you're in all this law between people and you have all these damages and you have all the how the court works, so you have that one section there that describes several versions of who's the Messiah and what's Olam Haba, and that kind of takes you off in a literary way, a hypertext kind of way, to Midrashim about Olam Haba. And then there's productivity about the concept throughout early Gaonic history, Middle Ages, depending on if it's about the individual soul versus the entire people or the world. It's a good topic.
How do the rabbis know this, or is it just wishful thinking?
Well, rabbinic knowledge is inherited tradition. It's cultural productivity.
Cool.
So what they're doing is they're not saying, I know as in fact. That's not their job. Their job is to produce a culture for you. It's to have references. How does a filmmaker know that this story is real enough to draw you in? Because it's based on human experience, the kind of thoughts you might have, the conversations that play themselves out, sometimes in real life, sometimes maybe in our fantasy worlds. That productivity of culture and knowledge is textual. And what we know is that there are texts. There's a Megillah, there's a Torah, and there's authority. And people have agreed to their authority. So we become students of the
right
authors.
But the authority, where are they getting their information from?
It's not a matter of pulling information only. It's not just information. It's inherited text. That's a cultural production as much as it is a storehouse of information that sits on some hard drive.
Well, it's belief. Simple belief.
It is belief, and then...
It does not require proof.
And it's belief, but it's also transferred over years, and no one's questioning whether or not it's true, capital T. The rabbi's job is to introduce you to a truth for you. And so you could call it belief. You can call it a productivity of knowing God, because God's name is truth. If you agree that this verse in Esther is about the world to come, you're in. And if you don't agree, you're out. Agree, disagree, prove, not prove, that's rationalism in the last two centuries. Do they know Purim is going to be the only holiday left? They're not claiming anything but that's a truth we share. It's a very different concept, I think, than knowledge as we think about facts. That's rabbinic culture. So, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Omer Mehecha Here's where it's from. It's not from that verse about Purim that's going to be in the future. V'zichram lo yasuf mizaram, nor shall their remembrance cease from their descendants. That's the verse we know. And he says that from this phrase, it's not going to be forgotten. Again, who knows that it's not going to be forgotten? Only God. Right? And we exclaim such a concept as truth in one of the Hoshanot at Sukkot. We say, God is what? Yodea Machshavot. The one who knows all thoughts. Hoshiana. God save us. So that is part of what we believe about our God. If God is the only one who can know all those thoughts, then we know that Esther is divine. Gemara now is going to go to something very concrete. You wanted all that God discussion, and you wanted all the Ruach HaKodesh, the divine nature of the Book of Esther? Let's bring it back down to the mitzvot that really are happening down here in this world. Umatanot v'Evyonim, the Gemara cites a brayta which defines the mitzvot, the obligations on Purim. Tanei Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef taught in a brayta, Umishloach manot ish l'reihu. The Megillah states, and you send portions one to another, and that is verse 22 in that chapter, La Soto Tam Yomei Mishte, you should make them into days of drinking and feasting, the Simcha, and happiness and joy, Umishloach manot, and portions, Ish l'Re'ehu, a person to his friend, Umatanot Levyonim, and gives to the poor. So let's start with Matanot Levyonim. Let's explore Matanot Levyonim, because what happens if we start with Mishte and Simcha? We may never get to Matanot Levyonim.
Maybe.
But the truth is that Matanot Levyonim has to be taken care of and planned according to the way some in Machshevet Halakha. Before you actually start your feast and your partying, so that you can actually make tzedakah plans. So we're far enough away from tzedakah plans on the day of Purim that we can actually start with a little mishteh. I brought a little mishteh to make the night interesting, so come. We'll have a little mishteh as we start to study this section.
Mishem, 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 Mish
Back to your seats. Let's keep learning. Actually, would take
a
water? Coke Zero.
Coke Zero.
I mean, the Book of Esther. In other words, there was obviously a discussion around whether or not we could say that everything in Torah or in Tanakh was truly through divine.
Yeah, right.
Let's say revealed with either divine spirit, thank you very much, or actually from the mouth of God on Sinai. And as canonization happened, you have more and more discussion about which books are in, which books are out, and you also have discussion which books are divine, and why doesn't it say anywhere by Omer Adonai El Mordechai Le Mor.
Gotcha.
I think that they're just having fun though as well. Saying, of course we know this, it's in our canon, and where is God? Because so many people ask, where is God? Okay. Here we go. So we're in Matanot Levionim on 7A4, and Tana Rav Yosef, he says, you're going to send portions to your friends. Two portions to one man, and then also matanot levyonim, gifts to the poor. Shtei matanot lishnei v'nei adam, two gifts to two people, meaning one gift to each of two people. So mishloach manot becomes two portions to one person. Matanot levyonim becomes one portion to each of two people. Gemara relates an incident though. Rabbi Yehuda nesia shadar leila Rabbi Oshaya. On Purim, Rabbi Yehuda didn't see a sense of Rabbi Yoshaya and said, what? Amta le'egla tilta, a calf born third to its mother, v'garga dechamra, and a bottle of wine. So what did he send? A nice thigh of meat and a bottle of wine. Shalach le'Rabbi Yoshaya sent back to him the following message. Kayamta banu Rabbeinu, our teacher, by giving us these gifts, you've what? Kiyamta. You've fulfilled the mitzvah of Mishloch Manot Ish L'Reihu Matanot Levyonim, sending portions to one another and gifts to the poor.
Oh, no, there's an interview you're adding there. Oh, maybe the people aren't so well.
Now, what's the novel point of his reply? So first of all, there are those who say that his response says what? What does he have to be in order for that response? He has to be poor. You have to realize that he's talking about himself. Rashi says on the first line, Hachi Garsinan, Kiyamta Banu Rabbeinu Umishloach Manot. Deha Tre Manotika. You have two portions here. So therefore, it's Mishloach Manot. Two portions. Adar Shalach Le'ihu. And then he says to him in response, Lo Garsinan Le'haka. Taska de chashva ka milei timarim. It's filled with dates. That's the next suvia. Go back. The first one is that he sends the portions to one another and gives to the poor, meaning that he's fulfilled both. The issue with this piece of the Gemara is that perhaps it's really not also Matanot Levyonim. There are other versions. Rashi says, Lo Garsinan Lehacha, we don't have this Nusach, meaning what? Look down on the bottom if you've got the art scroll. The words Matanot Levyonim are deleted by the Gra and Bach. So you don't have the words Matanot Levyonim. What do you have? Just Mishloach Manot. That would seem to make more sense. Why? Because we just got done saying that Mishloach Manot is what?
Two gifts to one person.
So, listen to this. Rav Chananel and Ritva have a variant reading of the Gemara, which accords with the version of the incident recorded in the Yerushalmi. Rav Yudah and Nesia sent Rav Hoshaya Rava one thigh and one bottle of wine. Rabbi Hoshaya sent back the following message to him. By giving us these gifts, you have fulfilled the mitzvah of gifts to the poor, but not the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot.
I forgot the word low.
Why? Rav Hoshaya says, you haven't fulfilled it because one of them is what? It's a bottle of wine. And therefore, you can't send it as Mishloach Manot. The novel approach in the Bavli, in that case then becomes the response of Rav Hoshaya, which is, you sent me Mishloach Manot. Meaning what?
It fulfills it.
That argument has legs. Nothing to do with the thigh. Because the question is whether or not I could send wine, liquor, grape juice, and fulfill my obligation under halakha. And you'll see that every now and then this question will come up, generation after generation, within the whole nature of trying to fulfill Mishloach Manot. Can we really fulfill Mishloach Manot with a mashke, something to drink? The Bavli wins out. And people now include that with their Mishloach Manot. Yerushalmi did not argue for that. So sometimes within two different Talmuds, you'll have differences of opinion, and however the story plays out, sometimes that affects our halachic rulings later on. Okay? Okay, so that's an interesting question. And if you have the notion that you include Matanot Levyonim, could be that what Rav Hoshaya is saying in the Bavli is that, oh, you could have used these, if I wasn't poor, for the mitzvah of Matanot Levyonim. So just like I'm telling you that you fulfilled the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot with these two items, you could have very well sent either of these to Matanot Levyonim. What's the problem with that? It's not really clear. If you have in the Girsa, Matanot Lev Yoni. Because what might he be saying as well? He feels as though, different than the Braita, trying to disprove it, that since he's rather poor himself, that, and we don't see him as one of the wealthy Rabbanim, that he is claiming you've both fulfilled your obligation, and then by sending me these two things, Matanot Lev Yonim. Now, is he saying completely fulfilled Matanot Lev Yonim, or is he saying another person still needs some type of Matanot Lev Yonim? Again, that's a question that comes up in studying the passage. Am I one of the two people you have to fulfill that mitzvah with, and have you done it? Or these two things to one person stand in contradistinction to the way the Braita said it, and that is, you have to send two distinct people one item.
But what's the reason that Mishnah doesn't come to Yerushalmi?
Because in the Yerushalmi, listen again, send back the following message. By giving us these gifts, you have fulfilled the mitzvah of gifts to the poor.
No,
so we learn oppositely that what? Mishteh doesn't count. There's no kiddush on Purim, except for when you write one and it's full of shtuyot. I don't know if you've ever heard that. It's great.
What does that mean?
It's a bunch of silly... It's a bunch of putting verses from here and there and different tunes from different kiddushes from throughout the year all into one place and having it all mashed up. Parody. Literate parody. Musically literate verses from different places. But I think that what it gets to is that they're saying that these portions were for the festivities and the feast you're supposed to make, according to the Book of Esther.
That's my confusion. I can understand that it has to be something that person really needs to sustenance. Whereas the Shlach Manot could include the drinks from which one imbibes, because there isn't the notion of it's not being given only because that person can't afford to support himself.
Well, in this case, I think there's a big distinction between Mishloch Manot, which is Isla Re'ehu, and it's just for a certain, right, adornment of the meal.
Yeah, something I would think.
And sustaining someone's needs. Sustaining someone's needs.
That I would think you couldn't give them. I would understand why it wouldn't count. Why you're supposed to give them food.
The only reason why I'm hedging is because what happens when you really take seriously the mitzvah of drinking on Purim? If I'm an Evyon, I mean, what's at stake here is whether or not, and this is kind of the end, and I'll foreshadow, okay? What's at stake in the first part of this story is what's at stake in the end of the passage we're about to read, which is at stake in all the sources about drinking that I want to bring to the table. And that is, how serious are we about drinking? What role does it play? How much is one supposed to drink? And if I have to supply somebody with a bottle of wine, everything's at stake here. Because if I'm poor, I'm less likely even to have that than I am a pot, let's say, to make a meal, a suda. To make some type of meal, I have a loaf, a little bit of a loaf of bread. Big loaf, small loaf. So that's, I think, piece of the discussion.
I think it's an important piece. Because of the way we live, I don't think of giving the gift as being something that's consumed immediately. But what you're saying is exactly correct. They needed it for then, not for weeks.
Right.
So that,
right.
And there's one footnote that says it has to be prepared food. It has to be ready to eat.
Thank you.
Oh, so that thigh was ready to eat.
So that wasn't the presumably wasn't an uncooked thigh.
Well, then, because otherwise you have to cook it.
Right.
And he couldn't enjoy the holiday and get drunk.
Right. Maybe it was smoked. Maybe it was cured.
No, but ready to eat.
Ready to eat.
But it would stay.
Ready to go. But it was, it's a good point to say out loud that it's very different than you get those baskets of Mishloach Manot and they're around the house for 3.5 weeks. It was, a lot of that was for making sure the festivities happened. Well, by Yom, that very day. Okay. So let's do the other incident that's here on sending portions. Rabba Shadar Le Lamari Bar Mar Biyada Baye. Rabba sent the Baye to Mari Bar Mar. Malay Taska De Kashva. A basket filled with dates. Umile Kasa Kimcha De Avashuna. And a cup filled with the flour of roasted wheat. Okay? So the flour is ground, according to Rashi, from early ripened ears of wheat that had been roasted. Right? Such flour permanently retains a sweet flavor, according to Rashi. Amar Le Abai. Abai says to Rabba, Hashta Amar Mari. Amari will now say about you, I Chakla'a Malka Leheve. If a peasant becomes a king, Dikula Mitzavare Lo Nachi. Does he not take the basket, which he used to feed his animals, down off his neck? Meaning what? Abaye intimates to Rabba, according to Marsha, you've become the royal head of Pumbedita, but the gifts you send, Mari, are very ordinary, commonplace items. Very simple stuff. So then, within Halacha, about Mishloach Manot, by the way, there's a big kind of discrepancy and difference between some people who think it's got to be boxed and ribboned and cellophane and perfect and this and that, and people who will come and say, here's a hamantashen, and here's a this, and this is really from my heart, Mishloach Manot. You will see that there's some sense of how the mitzvah gets played out with sending portions to people on this holiday. Hada Shadar Le'ihu, Mari Bar Mar sent back to Rabba and said, Malay Taska Dizan Gavila, a basket filled with ginger, Umile Kasa Defil Palta Aricha, a cup filled with long peppers, and Abaye says, Hashta Amar, and Rabba will now say, Ana Shadri Le'chulia, I sent him sweet foods, the Ihu Shadar Le'chorfa, and he sends me back bitter ones. So, there's also this kind of reality still in cultural circles that really do Mishloach Manot back and forth, right? Some, say a family comes and they have a hamantashen and a truck with this and a little bottle of wine or grape juice and they give it to you. And so you have a bunch prepared on your table. And when someone walks in and knocks at the door, gives you Mishloach Manot, you go to your table and you grab one and you give it to them. Some of those Mishloach Manot, in order to be quote-unquote different than your average chewy candy from Israel and a sour stick for the children and maybe a bottle of this and a nice dates from you know the Galil, the Negev, they'll have something of a unique twist. Cornbread mix, a little baking pan, a bottle of olive oil from, you know, kosher from here or there. So, it's funny because some people see that as being creative and adding an element and just put this together, stick it in the oven, having a unique something on term day. And some people, you know, see it only as, wait a minute, doesn't it have to be sweet? Doesn't it have to be, you know, made this way? And there'll be discussion. And these kinds of things are happening to this day. It's really funny how culturally it's right reflected right in the Gemara.
So, Matanot Le'Evyonim, that means that somebody gives to somebody who has nothing. It looks like the discussion here that the one who has nothing gives something to the one who has something. So, first of all, how the guy who has nothing can give?
He has to get his first. Once he gets one, he can so, keep
so
his
like
it.
No, wait. Because the mitzvah is to give to the Evyonim, not to take from the Evyonim.
No, listen, everybody has an obligation in our tradition to give tzedakah, whether you're an Evyon or you're not. That's what's at the heart of the whole tzedakah system, is that you may be completely receiving tzedakah as your livelihood, you still have an obligation to give.
Yeah, but in this case, the rich gave to the poor and the poor gave back to the rich.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make sense.
You want to get like a mensch.
You don't take a poor and make him give like a mensch. That's not the way it goes.
You know? Have to give the same thing. Right. He can give less.
Yeah, but they are discussing, they are negotiating. You gave me this, I gave you that.
Can you really give tzedakah to a rich person? I mean, it's not really charity.
Oh, that's why it's Mishloach Manot and not Matanot Levyonim.
Okay.
That's why it's the portions.
Okay.
That is a great distinction on Purim, right? Because you wouldn't want to be sending, perhaps, someone Matanot Levyonim if they didn't really need it. On the other hand, can you give a little tzedakah to even someone who's really wealthy?
Sure.
Right. So, because there's a certain level of intentionality, but a Matanot Levyonim on this holiday has definitely not become connected to just the giving of gifts and presents. Actually, the notion that you find the communities poor who really are destitute coming to a place where they can have something for Purim is very popular in communities where that reality exists. Otherwise, in certain communities, I like to really, on this holiday, even with Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levyonim, altogether wrapping it up, because if there is any truth to this first piece that you can wrap them up together, to me it's beautiful to make sure the soup kitchens in all over Israel are ready for their Purim feast, the day of Purim, with gifts to the gleaners. That to me is among the highest.
The soup kitchen in Israel should be open every day, not only.
They are, but you can give unique and distinct gifts to make sure that today it's open, and tomorrow is open, and for Purim it's open. It's an ongoing need. And the reality here, too, is that we have people who need those gifts. Anyway, the back end, yeah?
Well, I'm a little interested. The tzedakah for the rich corrupt is the way that they pay bribes.
The way that they pay bribes to their friends?
Why do societies pay bribes? So I'm just curious if we could think of it that way.
Well, the Torah legislates against that everywhere.
Okay.
You know, they have a different name for that.
There's
a different name for that. You know, you can't have shochad. You can't really take a bribe.
No, I understand you really can't, but I'm sure that it's dealt with, so I just find out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go through the piece. Amar Abaye. Abaye says what? Ki nafki mi beimar havash savana. When I left Master's or Rabba's house, I would go to Mari. I was so full. Ki mitai lahatam. When I arrived there, karivu li shitin sai de shitin mine kadera. He brought me 60 plates with 60 types of cooked food. V'achali bahu shitin pluge, and I ate 60 pieces, one off of each plate. Uvishula batraita, the last dish they gave me, havu karile tzli kedar. They called pot roast. which for some children just think that's the most terrible dinner.
What?
Pot roast. Oh, really? Because the stringy meat. I remember, like, all the time, the stringy meat. Right? What's that?
I don't need it now either.
Oh, you don't. Anyway, it was in the Gemara. It's a dish. Uvai lemechas tsa abatra. And after eating it, I wanted to eat the plate. Amar Abaye comments and says, "Hainu de Amrei in Shei." This is illustrative of what people say. Katin anya velo yada. A poor person does not know when he's hungry. Inami. It also bears out with this prophet saying, "Ravcha livzima shchiach." Room can always be found in one's stomach for sweet things. In other words, dessert, right from the Gemara. Right, it's right there.
They intuitively know about the dessert shop.
That's right. Now,
60 things. So we just heard that it doesn't have to be 60 things. It has a different number. So how do they respond to the fact that this is really way over and above what's recommended?
So, in other words, everybody in their own capacity. And when you're going to the master's house, yeah, because, you know, we could ask the same question. To a certain point, right, there were Rabbanim who, in the early 2000s, came out with harsh critiques against the excessive spending on weddings and bar mitzvahs. Really harsh critiques, to the point where they outlawed, in terms of heter and isur, they made it isur, and especially given your income level, it's forbidden to spend X number of dollars on this wedding. which was economically very smart. This is, you know, after the go-go 90s and before the 2008 crash. They were just looking at it as money wasted. However, there's a certain kind of celebration here that a person can afford and a person can enjoy and a person can enjoin others to come and enjoy. And that's okay. And there's meat and there's dessert. I will tell you where it does play itself out in not so wonderful a way. Some communities send mishloach manot on behalf of the community to everyone in the community, right? But only the people who could afford the largest donation have their name on the card to say Happy Purim, right? So in my estimation, that defeats the entire purpose. If you're all members of a place, all the names should go, and you should say to people, whatever you can contribute to this particular mitzvah of Mishloach Manot
this year
should be the way that you take pride in having this come to a member of your community, Ish L'Re'ehu, a person to his or her friend, this year at Purim. Right? So I think that that's been systematized in a very corrupt way around the Jewish world in America in terms of fundraising. I just comment on one of the sociological features of how Mishloach Manot systems are put to work right now. Some places will say, you only want to send to 20 people, X number of dollars a pop. Well, what if I want to send to 100 people, but I can't afford X number of dollars a pop? So put my name and let me donate what I can. The spirit of the Gemara is exactly that. So if we were to take ethics out of the Talmudic discussion, I think that would be the better way for anybody to have such a system. Maybe.
What about that footnote explaining that this is a parable?
Okay, so we're going to get to that. That's a good footnote, right?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting footnote. Chatam Sofer says the following about the sugya. He says, a very difficult passage. When Abaye left his teacher Rava, he thought he was full of Torah. That is, he was under the impression that he had already achieved his full measure of Torah study. Upon arriving at the house of Mari Bar Mar, Mari discussed with Abaye topics from each of all 60 tractates in the Talmud. Okay, there are a couple more. The tractates are referred to as plates, for they are the framework on which their contents lie. In each tractate, Abaye learned from Mari a new point that he didn't know. The last tractate they studied together was Pesachim, Pesach, and they discussed the topic of Tzli Kedar, pot roast, whether the Pesach sacrifice can be cooked without water and its own juices. Since it was 30 days before Pesach, Abaye wished to continue and study the entire tractate. He wished to eat the plate. For two reasons, a person might mistakenly believe he's full of Torah. One, a little bit of a Musar lesson. He's unaware of his own ignorance. And two, he's unaware of the depth of Torah. Abaye concludes with two sayings that counteract these two mistaken notions. One, a poor person doesn't know when he's in when he's hungry. In other words, an ignorant person doesn't know when he really needs to eat or study more Torah. And two, room can always be found for sweet things. That is, the Torah's full of sweetness, and it's always possible to uncover deeper explanations. That's why you can have your children study this sugya. Not get dessert. No, because here's what I
don't believe. It.
Here's what I love about that, though. Excuse me, I have to find a tissue.
Here, I have the box.
Oh, thank you. And to me, it says more about the fact that amongst people who have plenty, the gifts are formalities, whereas the poor person was really taken care of here. The guy who went to the house was treated like a king.
I think so, and just to get back to your question, does it mean that? I think this is a perfect example of Davka, the Hatam Sofer, reading a metaphorical Torah, Musar message about study and student, being a student and a Talmid, into a sugya that's really not about it. And even though he'll be among the chief leaders of anti-reformist, anti-Wissenschaft, and anti-modernist kind of looks at the world, this is a very, if you will, metaphorical read.
But it's retro at the same time. I mean, the Musar is valid, regardless.
It's retro at the same time, but because it's about Torah study. Yes. I'm just saying that that kind of read sometimes gets belittled by people who only want to see the Gemara for what it is.
I don't think you should ever belittle beautiful teaching. You don't have to believe that the sugi is literally about it for there to be any less significance to the teaching.
Right, but you know what I mean, that people can say, look, it doesn't say that literally, so how could you possibly be making that claim here? It's a nice drosh.
Beautiful.
It's a really nice drosh. What were you saying, though, about the actual facts of the case?
I said it's the story, it's nice to me, because here's a messenger who has nothing. These people are talking about the limited gifts they got from one another, it's sort of almost critiquing. But then the messenger who actually brought the gift, when he gets to Mari Bar Mar's house,
right. There's
a big open house there, they're passing hors d'oeuvres, and he's being treated like a king, even though he's nobody, so... a nice experience. So I guess there was more made available for the poor than are taken by those who are of use.
Right. Right. And it can be in the feast or it can be in the gifts. Right? So to make that feast, to make that Purim Suda.
Purim Tish, I should have said. He went to the Purim
Tish. That's right. Right. So that's a nice piece too. By the way, in terms of actually eating together, the Gemara wants to make the next point that it is nice to have a feast together. And not just do it alone. Abaye bar Avin, v'Rav Chanina bar Avin, mechalfei suda taihu lahadade. They exchange their Purim feasts with another. And the Gemara says about that what does that mean? That they're actually not eating alone. That they come and they send portions to each other, and they exchange the meals and portions at the same time. They had food for their feasts, and they're doing it together. Now we get to this next piece. Getting into our drinking sources. Rabbi Seira, Rabba and Rav Seira, Avdusud that Purim Bahade Hadade. They had their Purim feast together. Ibasus, they became intoxicated. Kam Rabba arose, Shachate Rabbi Seira, and he killed Rabbi Seira. There have been many Purim spiels that have asked that question.
Was it kosher?
Was it kosher?
So I think it was kosher.
So a bunch of, we always had a Purim spiel of sorts by the 8th graders, and the 8th graders would read this sugya, and we would talk about the issue of drinking and alcohol and alcoholism and the whole notion of wine and religious freedom. And anyway, they acted out this sugya sometimes in front of the 7th graders and their parents, and they would stop and say, Wait a minute. The knife's not sharp enough. It's not going to be glatt. This is the level of kind of humor that is this literate humor that we're producing, right? Now, whether this is a humorous piece or it's a musar piece, it's a piece about an ethical teaching, gets back to the beginning about matanot le'evyonim, and what do they do when they don't know how to handle drinking and they don't know what to do with drink. All this comes into play. Rabbah arose, Rabbah arose and slew Rabbi Zeira. L'machar bai rachamei v'achaye. The next day Rabbah prayed for mercy on Rabbi Zeira's behalf and revived him. L'shana. L'shana. L'shana amarle. The following year, Rabbah asks Rabbi Zeira, Nite mar v'nave tzudat purim v'hade hadade? Let Master come and we'll have the Purim feast together.
That's so fast.
He says, Amarle, he says to him, Rabbi Zeira says, lo b'chol shata v'shata mitrach eish nisa. Not every time does a miracle occur. So, a couple of the notes. Rabbi Avraham, the son of the Rambam, says the following about it. Quotes the passage as a classic example of the Gemara's occasional use of hyperbole in cases where it's absolutely clear that the literal meaning is not intended. He explains that actually Rabbah dealt Rabbi Zeira a blow that wounded him grievously. Due to the seriousness of the wound, and possibly because it was located in Rabbi Zeira's neck, the Gemara describes it as shechita, a term which usually coincides with what? The fatal slitting of the throat of a kosher animal. Maharsha maintains that the Gemara is not to be understood literally. Rather, Rabbah forced Rabbi Zeira to drink an excessive amount of wine. So that's the Maharsha we concentrate on. Rather, Rabbah forced Rabbi Zeira to drink an excessive amount of wine from which Rabbi Zeira became deathly ill. Rabbah then prayed that Rabbi Zeira should not die from the illness. In other words, what? He really overdid it. And the only thing he knows how to do is respond right with prayer. Rabbi Zeira recovers. The Meiri proposes that the correct reading is schate, with a sin, which means he squeezed him. Who knows how? Dancing, showing some strength, what have you. Okay, so I want to focus here on drinking on Purim. I've prepared this package. Can I pass it to you and take one and pass it down? Yeah. There's more sources here than I think we're going to get through. But it's a nice packet of sources, and it's a great issue and inyan, if you will. Okay. So you see the questions, the animating questions for the packet here, for the unit. How does the function of drinking on Purim contrast with its function on other Jewish holidays? What does Rava mean by what? Until he cannot distinguish between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai? Because that really is at the central part of the obligation. Okay? And then the halachic guidelines and underlying meaning. Go to the next page in the packet. You see the Gemara there? So the original place where it says about the obligation for drinking comes a little before, and that is, it's actually on the page here. Yes.
Yeah.
You see where it says Amar Rava?
Rava said one is obligated to become
right. So it says, Amar Rava Mechayve Inchi Levusre Bepurim or Bepuria Ad Delo Yada Ben Aror Haman Levaruch Mordechai. So
it's on page 5.
It's on 7b1
right.
If you go back to where I left it out. Okay? Now, I purposely started with the story of Rabbi Zeira to say, which came first? So just some thought about which came first. Go back to 71 for a second, if you're in the English one, and I just read it from the page in the packet. The Gemara says after they exchange meals with one another, before the actual story that I read you, Rava says the following, Mechayev inchi levusume befuria, one's obligated to become intoxicated, and it says with wine on Purim in the art scroll. Because the whole sugya had started, remember, with that bottle of wine. Ad delo yada ben arur haman levaruch Mordechai. Until one does not know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. These words are recited, actually, as part of a prayer in the Yerushalmi. And it says, Arur Haman, Baruch Mordechai, cursed is Haman, blessed is Mordechai, Arur or Zeresh, cursed is Zeresh, Brucha Esther, blessed is Esther, cursed are all the wicked, and blessed are all the Jews. Rava rules that one must become intoxicated with wine until one's unable to recite this prayer with clarity. That's originally what he means. It's such a mouthful that if I can say that with perfect articulation, I just have not had enough. Others explain that Rava refers to a poem, the refrain of which alternated between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. One person would chant the poem, and after each line, others would respond with the appropriate refrain. On Purim, one must become so drunk that one does not know which refrain to recite. So that it's antiphonal mayhem. And if you think about the history of prayer, then you become so festive within that partying and that liturgical experience that you're basically hearing this cacophony of responses to this certain part of the liturgy, and it has nothing to do with personal status in terms of intoxication. And that is so opposite of the decorum of where we would have liturgical experience that would be antiphonal, a call out and a response, a call out and a response, that that's what made the difference on Purim. Okay. Turn the page. The Maharal says about wine. Because we're really thinking that it's wine because of the way the whole Gemara is set up. That wine's not part of the world, for wine has a divine aspect to it in that it gladdens God and man. Perush hayayin eino ra'ui lo'olam hazeh, ki hayayin yesh bo inyan elokei, sheharei hu misameach elokim v'anashim. V'davar zeh yachol ha'adam adad lahavin shehu yotzei min pinimit ha'anav shehu nistar. This can be understood by noting that wine comes from the inner part of the grape, which is hidden. This indicates that wine comes from a very hidden place and has a spiritual aspect that's not part of the visible world. Now, v'chol davar shehu chashu v'yesh bo inyan elokei, all things that are powerful and possess a divine aspect, im yishtamesh bo kera'ui kone. If you use it correctly to acquire a spiritual ascent, al yad zemala. According to that, he'll go and reach that ascent. Im eino mishtamesh bo kera'ui kone al yad zemita. But if you don't use it right, it's going to actually lead you to death. V'chein. And when one drinks wine correctly, v'chein kasher yishte ayayin kera'ui mefakeach oto v'notem lo hasecha al-yon. He's made sharp and given divine wisdom. But v'im eino kach rak hasheshote oto l'tavato. But if you only do it for your base desires, v'yishtaker and you get drunk, mevilo yalala umita. You bring upon yourself death and mourning, wails, yalala. Those are the wailings. What's that?
Ugly.
Yes.
This is why we say l'chaim, so I still don't know why there should be a machlok.
Very good. Very good.
So I see this as the first attempt at a breathalyzer test. This is a way of calculating a dose, and it's actually independent of whether it's wine or whatever form. And in those days, it used to depend on how much they diluted the wine, too.
Right, exactly.
But it seems to me that this notion is designed to create a safe level at which you stop, as opposed to unbridled drinking, so that there isn't excess.
Right.
And so this is, and we, as you know, in the modern day, before the breathalyzer, the cops had a very simple functional test, right?
Yes.
Could you walk a
straight line? Say the alphabet backwards, I believe.
So this is, to me at least, it's an attempt to try to define something that relates to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we say in medicine, the only thing that that distinguishes a miracle drug from a poison is the dose. So here it's all about dosing properly.
And you'll see that the texts are going to play some of that out. And the machloket, the argumentation between the Rishonim, already gets into some of those questions. How much? Now, they even know a little bit about different people.
I was going to say, the
they
variation
even know that.
Between individuals.
You'll see. You'll see in the sources. Ramban says in his commentary to Bereishi, just in terms of the wine and the nature of alcoholic beverage, the nichtav inyan hayayin b'noach, the whole Noach wine episode, ki yesh bo az arra mimenu, yotzer miparashat nizirut. That there's a deep, deep warning in there, more powerful than the Nazarite message. Because even though the righteous Noach, with all his righteousness, saved the world, because it was according to the wine that he was led astray by, that he brought disgrace upon him and curse to his offspring. Right.
The yayin did it to him.
That's right. Jay is pointing out that it's Hebrew. Hecheti hayayin, that the wine caused him to sin.
But if the cutoff point is whether you cannot distinguish between Aruah Haman and Aruah Mordechai and all that, that's one step beyond clarity of good difference between good and evil or good and bad. So how can you blame that guy who came, who kamba shachatata, who slew his self? He was at that point. He couldn't tell right from wrong.
Yeah. So
isn't that the point that's one step too far, to telling right from wrong?
Right. So that's going to be the problem with that kind of getting drunk.
Yeah, but the definition of you may drink until the point where you cannot distinguish between Baruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai. You cannot tell which one is which is right and which is wrong.
Right, so, except that if you go with the other interpretation that we talked about, which is Rava's, and that there's this poem, and that you're saying the liturgy in a way that's full of confusion, then you don't have to deal with that issue that you're claiming now, and that is that you get so drunk you wouldn't know. It's just a matter of bilbul in the experience of reading Megillah.
There's a fine line between overdoing.
Well, it's a different kind of overdoing it, frankly. It has nothing to do with being drunk. If it's about the liturgical bilbul. Kol ha-kolot.
Yeah,
and the responses. So you can't even tell who's saying it first and who's responding now.
It results from intoxication, no?
Yeah, a little bit, but also the way we do it.
Okay.
And just a little wine. Because just a little wine we use for Kiddush. And just a little wine we use at Pesach. A little bit more than a little. let's just remind ourselves that exactly that's the next set of sources to ask ourselves the question again. Mm-hmm. Source 4, Source 5, and Source 6 are those we just talked about. Right? The whole notion of ad lo yada, and you should do it, and does that really mean confusion, or does it mean, like Rava said, liturgical confusion, or is it really drunkenness? And what is the danger? Was it that he gave him too much wine and he just passed out, or that he got so sick from the wine and that he prayed for his recovery and that he says, no, I'm not coming by you next year? You really think that it's all about drinking this much? Maybe that's the message in the sugya, that if you're going to be a place that abuses the liquor, the alcohol, the too much wine syndrome on the holiday, not every year does a miracle occur. I'm not coming. He puts it like, last year there's a miracle I survived your Purim. And that today is part of the sichsuch in the Jewish community. How much is too much for certain of these days? Especially when you want to engage in a little bit of mishte, a little bit of drink. How much is too much? Turn the page. Here, you'll even see there are sources where it really is forbidden to be drunk. Balam or on the reef. Amar Rabba, chayav inish lidusume befulia. Rabba, right, says, a person's obligated to get drunk on Purim. Katav harav Ephraim, so the Rif says, mehahu uvda dekam Rabba shachate, from the fact that Rabba got up and slaughtered Rabbi Zera, v'amar le, and then he says to him, ta navid, and let's go make Purim again, and he says, itche le meimra de Rabba, the late hilchata kavate. And the following year, Rabba suggested they make another Purim feast together, whose offer was then what? Declined by Rabbi Zera. Below Shapir Dami Lemevet Hachi. It's not proper to actually make a meal like this because of the issue of the wine. He didn't kill him with a knife. He didn't squeeze him like this other interpretation. He gave him too much to drink. And that's inappropriate. So that's this look on that. The Beit Yosef and Orach Chaim. Now the Beit Yosef, this is where we get serious about what we codify, because the Beit Yosef is Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's writing a commentary on what we call the Arba'at HaTorim, the four columns. And I just realized that in our library up here, we have neither. And so we have the Shulchan Aruch, but we don't have the Tor Beit Yosef, and then the Shulchan Aruch. So I'm buying a Tor Beit Yosef in honor of this class from my discretionary, so that we have more Sfarim from which to learn, saying tonight. Okay? So the Orach Chaim writes that when Rava says the following, Chatuv v'Orach Chaim, Chayav inish livsume befuria, and by the way, the whole Shulchan Aruch is based on the Beit Yosef, which is Rabbi Yosef Karo's commentary within the Torah, which is two centuries before the Shulchan Aruch. That's why it's so important, and it's longer form. So you really get his thinking and his philosophy. He says, one's obligated to get drunk on Purim. What do we really mean by that? Lo sheyishtaker shashchirut istur gamur. Not that one should get drunk. Inebriation is absolutely forbidden. Ve'ein lecha aveira gedola mizo. And there's no greater transgression. Shehu gorem legilui arayot, that leads to forbidden sexual relationships, ushfichut damim, and even to murder and violence, v'chama aveirot zulatan, and other kinds of transgressions. Now I will say, I've been witness to some of that in places that really go overboard with allowing for the drinking to happen, and who are kind of wrapped up in the emotional reality that they're living so close together and so right up, and they have arguments and they have reeves with this guy with the next neighbor and they still sit in shul, and it really turns bloody.
On Purim?
You know, it could be on a Shabbat, by the way. Such a thing. Right. So, the reality here is that you have very strong statements. Turn the page. But let's see what comes as well. Because just being completely against something, maybe that's not the balanced way that everybody saw the issue. Okay, one's obligated to be what? Chayav adam leharbot, but simcha b'yom zeh. you're obligated to have great joy. With food and with drink. Ad shelo yechsar shum davar. Where he's lacking nothing. In other words, you feel completely satisfied with your portion in the moment. Isn't that a nice way to think about what it's supposed to create for you? You're eating and you're drinking. From source 9. Umikol makom, any case, ein anu mitzuvim lehishtaker ulhachit atzmeinu mitoch hasimcha. However, we're not commanded to get drunk and demean ourselves during the festivities. We weren't commanded to be in absolute folly. Rather, in a great joy and delight, that we should arrive within that joy to love of God, and to a joy in which we can find great, deep, deep gratitude for the miracles that were wrought for us. Umashe Amarkan, and what's said, Ad Delo Yada Bein Arur Haman LeBaruch Mordechai, and what does that really mean then, if we don't know the difference? Kvar Pershu Kitzat Gaonim brings in Gaonic literature, post-Talmudic, 8th to 11th centuries, Shemimashis Kirach Harav, Kam Rav Shachatela Rabbi Zera, Nidchu Kolo Tama Devarim, where they said that the incident of Rabba and Rabbi Zera cited in proximity where Rabba got up and slaughtered Rabbi Zera indicates that the Talmud's rejection of Rabba's law. That what? That one should become completely intoxicated. He said through Shtia. So what does he mean through Shtia? Those who hold that he means only non-alcoholic beverages have a hard time proving that, because Shtia all over the place is alcoholic beverage. What is the measure? The measure here is whether or not someone feels particularly happy with his or her portion at this moment and can be full of gratitude to Hashem and respect for Kodesh Baruch Hu and respect for God. And if that is where it leads, that's the measure. It is permitted and even obligatory, though, certain sources say. And where does that stem from, that there are those who think that it is permitted? Well, first of all, in Sefer Bereishit, Kulam Chamesh Yadot V'yishtu V'yishtakru Imo. In Bereishit, there's this whole kind of thing about portions are taken from them from Joseph's table, and what happens when the brothers get together, right? That they become intoxicated with wine. Oh, so if that's the case, and I know it's permissible from Torah, let me now tell you, maybe there's a line of thought that it's permissible. Shabbat 66b in the Gemara, Amar Rav Chama Bar Guria, one may rub in oil and salt on the Sabbath, okay? Just as this oil is becoming clear, so let Chamre Deponia Bar Panita, and so let so-and-so wine become clear. In other words, that the wine, when they felt the effect, they would rub oil and salt into the palms of their hands so that they did feel a certain effect of wine, and it became a wine of simcha, and then they would kind of halt that and say, oh, I'm feeling so good, and they would stop their meal. Because what's the salt and oil? It's to clean, and then the oil would completely be like soap. Halacha implies that a person has reached the level of the drunkenness of Lot. At this level, he's considered as though he's entirely lost his mind. In other words, that he shouldn't have that level. Therefore, if he recited Shaman blessings like that, he has to recite it again later on. So they give you a measure of what it means to be over-intoxicated. This is the breathalyzer, right? So if you're like Lot,
too far.
To drink or not to drink. Rabbi Yeshua Pfeffer. It appears that the Orchel Chaim made his comment specifically with regard to this level of getting drunk, whereby a person denies his own consciousness and mind. Concerning the drunkenness of Lot, the Orchel Chaim rules that willfully entering the condition is a heinous crime. In this light, there's no longer any question on the Orchel Chaim, for instance, is recorded in Scripture and in the writings of Chazal, in which great and righteous leaders become drunk. The drunkenness mentioned by the Gemara does not refer to the drunkenness of Lot. Had the disciples become drunk to such a degree, it would have been difficult for them to take the prescribed antidote. The same is surely true of the Shvatim and other instances where drunkenness is mentioned. In other words, that Bereishit passage is what he's referring to. Indeed, Rav Leib Mintzberg, in the Torah Ti Bekir Bam, has written that it is certainly forbidden to willfully enter a level of drunkenness of law. Although the Shulchan Aruch does not mention this prohibition, though he cites it in the Beit Yosef, and quotes the obligation of becoming drunk on Purim without qualification, the intention is certainly not to reach the drunkenness of Lot, but only to reach the level of Shikor. How much should one drink then? So you go back and you look into the sources, and you see that it did play itself out, even according to the Rambam, who gives a measure. That measure is the following. What's the obligation on Purim? Ketzar chovat suda zo sheyochal basar v'yitaken suda na'a kafi asher timtza yado v'shote yayin ad shishtaker v'yirhadem b'shichru. So what does it mean? He should have a nice meal and prepare a nice meal as he's able, and he should also drink wine until he becomes drunk and falls asleep out of drunkenness. So what's not knowing the difference? So the Rambam? You had enough wine that you fell asleep. Now, how many people fall asleep with one good glass of red wine? Some people fall. Some people, they drink a little bit more. They don't even feel like they're falling asleep. This is the issue with individuals. So the Rambam actually has another answer. I think I may not have put it in here. He says, drink one more drink than you would have. What's that?
Than you normally would.
Right, exactly. So that's the amount. But again, that's drinking, and that is having it as part of your celebration.
We're trying to personalize.
And getting to the point that it's individual.
It's also not going so wild and so beyond. It's just a little beyond your usual, which is much more, manageable and...
And that your mind is a little bit like out there and not exactly here. And here's how that's actually explained in the Darkei Moshe on Or Chaim.
Can I just ask, it seems to me there's a very big difference between wine to be joyous in celebration. It's another, for some here, some of these refer to reaching a level of... better appreciation of religiosity as opposed to being joyful. So I put these in very different issues, because if you're saying that your spirituality is enhanced by wine, meaning your relationship with God is enhanced by wine, that's a very different thing to me than having a good time in a festival.
Right.
And the first is potentially more dangerous, because if that notion takes hold, then it seems like that's going to be something you're going to want to do all the time, because who doesn't want to be closer to God all the time?
Right.
As opposed to just having a defined event in which you participate as a celebrant.
Right. I can't say that notion didn't pass through to other sources, and there aren't people who write great spiritual texts about Purim and wine and Yotze Yayin Nichnas Sod, wine goes in and the secrets come out, and we're supposed to learn secrets of Torah and all this kind of thing. But not everybody goes that direction, I think potentially because of what you're saying. So they want to see it as what other type of celebration. This is a certain simcha, a certain sense of satisfaction in this moment, a certain sense of being inclined to party versus listen to the liturgy as it is stated. And in modern times, enough... And this is where I'll end with this last source, just to give you a sense of what the confusion is, right? Not going to the point where enough wine to praise God. He says, Darkei Moshe and Or Chaim. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, in our era, what is this whole confusion supposed to be about? So he takes it back from the Chiddushei Agudah and the Toldot Adam V'Chava. It's written that the numerical equivalent of the Hebrew letters of Aror Haman and Baruch Mordechai are identical, and this is back to what? Gematria. And one must drink enough to render himself unable to figure out the calculation. In other words, if your brain is going to go towards numbers and the letters and the adding up, and the Minhagim wrote that there was a liturgical poem where the refrain would alternate between Aror Haman and Baruch Mordechai, one needs clarity to not occasionally make a mistake. In other words, this whole sense of confusion about this one equals that one, and I don't know which one we're saying now. We're just saying everything's equal out there in terms of my experience of all this, because the whole place is up in this liturgical kind of singing and dancing and celebration. That's what I take from it. And ultimately, it says in maybe just this one final piece in the 1768-1828, the Yad Ephraim, a person must drink on permanently doesn't know, means that a person drinks only up until the point where he still maintains the ability to fulfill the obligation to give thanks and praise, but not beyond that point, since he would become confused. Going too far would render him unable to distinguish between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai, and therefore not have sufficient comprehension to praise God for the per miracles. So that there's one that does, versus this other one that's simply about the great confusion, hearkening back to Rava and how it's explained in terms of his kind of ability to be in this liturgical moment of great ecstatic backs and forths and not knowing the difference in this celebration with a little bit of wine and a little bit of intoxication perhaps to make it a celebration that goes beyond the norm. So what is it saying, by the way, though, about final word, about drinking and listening to the Megillah? And or being in shul, there are sometimes when it may be right, and sometimes when that liturgical experience extends quote unquote beyond the kriya. They didn't say do it during kriya; they said do it during this poem that you're saying back and forth. When did that poem happen? Some say it really only happened at the suda, at the meal and the festive meal, and some say it happened though within the context of the whole liturgical experience. Well, let's open. You're welcome. I had a lot of help, as you see, from this institute. Ner Le'elif is a Gemara series, and Rabbi Galinkin's Tshuva is on the end from the Shemri Institute. And a good summation of lots of